Hello, I'm Julian Baggini, and in this microphilosophy podcast, three very different scholars, all with roots in China, will be asking us to rethink hierarchy through the lenses of history, economics, feminism, Taoism, mathematics, and artificial intelligence. It's the latest in a series looking at how different philosophical traditions around the world shape the way we think. They've been made in conjunction with the Bogdun Institute's Philosophy and Culture Center, the goal of which is to develop fresh ideas through comparative and interdisciplinary work and relate these insights to the pressing issues of our day. My guests are Zhang Xian, an independent scholar whose research has taken him from Beijing to Stanford, Harvard and Munich, Robin R. Wong, Professor of Philosophy and Director of Asian Pacific Studies at Loyola Marymount University, and Taisu Zhang, who is Associate Professor at the Yale Law School, specialising in comparative legal and economic history. I began by asking Robin Wong why she believes that Taoism promotes very strong, positive ideals of femininity.
I want to say for Taoism, for example, the classical text, Tao Te Ching, define Tao as mother, so as a life force. Tao is very much value feminine energy, and this will be transformed to our actions, how we should act. So that will be very much talk about the softness and talk about we should flow like water, and water actually is appearing to be soft, but yet it's very powerful.
Well, that idea of power is the interesting one, isn't it? Because, I mean, hierarchy is thought of as being power over people. But you've got here in Taoism an idea of power which is a different kind of power. It's not an oppressive power. What kind of power are we talking about?
Yes, I will say it's empowerment. I will see hierarchy actually manifested as some sort of energy. So power is a competence in the way. It's ability. So the most better way to think about the power is empowerment, not power over. So I can give you lots of examples, like the parents-children relationship, teacher-students relationship, employer and employee relationships. Seems like you're always giving others space to allow others to be creative.
So you've got that idea then of empowering in those relationships, but there is still a hierarchy though, isn't there?
Yes.
There is still, so how does that work out? Because some people might think there's a contradiction between having power over someone and giving them power. There seems to be a tension, but you're saying that we have to understand these things as being reconcilable in some way. I can have power over you, for example, as a parent or as an employer, but that could be a power over you which also gives power to you.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. In allow you to do something. One of the things we talk about hierarchy, we talk about the relationships. So within relationship, it's about interaction. So I will think about the Taoist view to think about the hierarchy. One, yes, it's empowerment. Secondly, it's interactions. It's a mutually benefit. So yes, there is a power, but this power being used in such way become a energy, become the exchange energy, right? Become is a kind of like ability. Then another idea is a change. And so a hierarchy, you cannot think about this human relationship as a fixed forms, but rather it's a dynamic forms. So parents and the children relationship can change. So children will be taken as the aging parents. The student will surpass the accomplished teachers. Mm. So you can see this is a more dynamic aspect of hierarchy.
It's a very attractive idea, I think. Is it one which resonates with you, or does it just come up against problems from the disciplines that you come from? Taisu Zhang.
For historians, power is not something to be condemned or to be categorized. It's kind of like a natural condition, right? For most social scientists, you would basically say, you know, there are power relations inherent in pretty much any kind of relationship, and therefore there's no point in saying whether power is merely oppressive or generative. Of course, it can always be both. I, through my authority as a ruler, can delegate authority to certain other people, and at the same time that I'm exercising my dominion over them, I'm also empowering to accomplish certain kinds of things that they could not otherwise have accomplished without my grant. that kind of thing, especially if you think about it from kind of an institutional perspective, and you say institutions constrain and empower at the same time, you constrain certain freedoms for the greater good and for kind of greater human flourishing, there are myriads of theories in which power is not necessarily an oppressive thing. I would probably venture to propose that the portrayal of power as largely an oppressive force is kind of a modern Foucauldian Western post-World War II kind of understanding in which the pseudo-socialist egalitarian ideal is so prominent amongst Western thinkers that, you know, for perhaps not so much as academic reasons, but for political reasons and ideological reasons, the portrayal of power as a negative, as a kind of oppressive constraint becomes necessary. I would not say, as a matter of kind of objective social science pursuit, that that kind of portrayal has any actual force to it. Power obviously can be used for oppressive means, but the thing is, you know, there are power relations inherent in virtually any kind of institutions. It really matter at the institutions. Right? If you have an institution in which, you know, power is overly centralized, in which, you know, there is no accountability, there is no kind of exchange of power, then you tend to have the oppressiveness. It's not power itself that is to be morally questioned. I think it's the institutions that distribute and coordinate power that are morally questionable.
Unfortunately, I don't have the power to prevent someone moving a big ladder from outside, so apologies for any sort of a jangling in the background there. Well, let's turn actually to you, Jiang Chang, your work, because you come at this from the angle of, you know, your AI, mathematics, which might seem to a lot of people to be kind of abstract, kind of removed. But you think there are insights from there actually have important things to tell us about the nature of expertise and whether there should be hierarchies of expertise. Can you very briefly say what your core thesis is?
Yes, my core argument is very simple, that the world is complex. And to understand complex world, we need very complex algorithm or computation. And our brain usually do not do that rationally, or always does not process it rationally. They process it by intuition. And so my central thesis is that intuition is powerful but solitary. It can solve specific problems. And that's what expertise is. So experts, we think of them as those more reasonable or more rational people. That's entirely not true. Most of the experts use experience to hone their intuition over long periods of time. And my argument is that, in fact, we should not let those experts make decisions for several good reasons. One is that their expertise are necessarily narrow, because there is a mathematical trade-off between the depth and the width of expertise, and most of the problem we want to discuss in public life are broad rather than narrow. You know, if we really have a very narrow specialist problem, then we just hand it to specialists. But for deliberation, we have broader problems. And the second is that the experts have lots of cognitive biases because they are human. And they have cognitive and non-cognitive biases. Cognitive bias such as overconfidence. And non-cognitive bias such as sexism, racism, or that can be latent. And it's from a modern psychological research that even though experts realize they have biases, they cannot avoid it because intuition is automatic. This comes down to the biblical reversal of the biblical adage that you should remove the plank from your own eyes before you look at the specks in your brother's. It's actually very difficult to even feel there is a big plank in your own eyes. Yeah. So my solution is that rationality is social. That rationality is a social process that doesn't help us interact with the world at large, but help us interact with each other. And that's what's so powerful about human. We interact with each other more powerful. We're not intuitively or computationally more powerful than animals. We cooperate better. And that's where rational reasoning comes in.
Now, you have a kind of mathematical basis for this argument, but yes. It seems to me that we can come to the same conclusion perhaps without the mathematics. I didn't get the mathematics.
So this is what I mean by I'm using the new bottle for the old wine. But the good thing about the new bottle is it can get new wines too. So this kind of thinking can easily generalize to AI.
Right.
Because if we treat human as a computational machinery and AI is similar, we can say AI is doing things intuitively. There is a fundamental bottleneck for AI to explain it to us. Mm. Let me give you an example. If there is you have an AI doctor and it cranks through its algorithm and say cut off the kidney, that's a prescription. If you have a human doctor, you ask him, why do I cut off the kidney? AI say, my algorithm said so. Obviously, that won't work, right? So there's a great need of integrating AI into a society of reasoning being that is human, right?
I mean, does this idea that, you know, expertise is by its nature narrow and that you need a broader kind of social intelligence to solve problems, is that something which at all we find in any either hidden your historical studies or in Taoist literature, or is it a novel and challenging idea for you? Tai Su Zheng.
Well, so I would say perhaps that's true in certain contexts. On the other hand, most social questions are actually not necessarily that broad. So I agree, experts tend to be narrow. Perhaps there are certain people with higher intelligence than average who can be somewhat both broader and deeper than the average person. But yes, experts do tend to be narrow. Now, that said, it turns out that most of the actual social questions that we face that actually have social and political consequences, immediate ones, tend also to be narrowed down by the time they actually become a seriously debatable issue.
Can you give an example, perhaps, of a major political issue which actually boils down to something quite simple and
straightforward? So, for example, historical example of, say, 17th century English property rights. Right? There are broader discussions amongst jurists over whether we want private property or whether we want a certain form of. Now, what kind of social hierarchies do we want? How do our property relations facilitate those kinds of things? There are broader principle discussions. Those things rarely make it to actual political discussions in parliament or even in local manners, in all manners of life. What actually become the focal points of discussion are what should exactly be the institutions that govern mortgages? How long should you be allowed to redeem mortgages? How long?
I would say that's still a very broad question.
Well, that is, at the very least, a much narrower question.
It is, but the kind of expertise I'm talking about are things like, let's think of an example of a parole board making decision about parolees, whether we want to release them or not. There are expertise there are multiple factors to consider. Whether recidivism is obviously one important question, but there are other questions like social integration that's independent of recidivism. For example, experts like psychologists, they might be very good at assess the psychological stability of the prisoner, but that's just a very, very tiny aspect of it.
Okay, so we've got the core of them. There's an agreement that expertise is quite narrow, and there's an agreement
But of course, the question really is how narrow.
Yeah,
I'm guessing based on just what you just said that I probably have a view of expertise that is narrow, but not nearly as narrow as his.
Okay, let's park that disagreement then. Robin, do you want to come in on this?
Okay, yes. I think if I bring something Taoist perspective on this table, then we'll see maybe a couple things we can pay attention to. Now, one is we think about expertise. Expertise is actually only in particular time, particular place. So for Taoist view to think about our life is more complex.
Yeah.
So therefore, we cannot lock in ourselves in this particular time and space. So therefore, we should broaden our horizons. So that's the one thing. Expertise from now in this place, maybe you are, but the next time in a different place, you may be not. We cannot expecting experts always make right choice. Different time, different places, choice maybe not be a good one.
Which perhaps explains why very successful football managers sometimes become very unsuccessful football managers in a new club in a new country.
At a different time, right? So, so what are these we can take away from this kind of perspective is we can not using this fixed or dualistic view to look at the world, look at the reality. We need a better way, better lens to think about the world is constant in change and the change in the place in through the time. So we need pay attention to something non-present, something potential, and so don't have a fixed view to think about the world, but rather open-ended. You always can embrace the changes, and you always can prepare dealing with changes. So that's when your life will be more pleasant, relaxed, and yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the final thing I want to talk about is your work, Tai Su Zhang, which is around looking at history and gerontocracy. Now, you've got some interesting, you think there's a good evidence base that hierarchies, essentially hierarchies that are based on age, mm-hmm. have been, well, it can be and have been, very good for social equality in some way.
They've been good for a very specific kind of equality. They've been good for distribution of power across households, not necessarily within households, but across households. Mm. They've also been fairly good at, based on that cross-household distribution of power, at promoting economic equality. This is strictly in our kind of pre-industrial setting, because modern history, once the West rises up, most of the societies sort of follow suit and they try to kind of dismantle their gerontocracies. So you don't really have a good contemporary example of how this actually functions, apart from perhaps South Korea and parts of Japan. Yeah. I wouldn't stake my academic career on this, but you know, but I would suspect that the model is generalizable enough that it actually explains quite a bit about distributions of status and distributions of wealth, even in contemporary societies.
Well, let's just focus in a little bit. So first of all, why is it then that a hierarchy based on age tended in that society at least to have this kind of equalizing effect?
Well, basically, the determining condition is that up until industrialization, and perhaps the same is true in most modern developed societies, the life expectancy difference between a relatively poor person and a relatively rich person was not great, right? So you have a fairly comparable chance of becoming fairly old and senior if you come from a landless household, as you would if you were the major landlord in the entire region. Now, of course, that's not always true, but that tended to be true often enough. Most communities have a fairly large number of low-income, low-wealth, but high-seniority individuals. And those individuals under the Confucian ideal of seniority and gerontocratic hierarchies would actually wield considerable political power. Now, that's an ideal type, but if you look at the actual historical evidence, it does turn out that at least compared to most other comparable sets, England, Japan, France, there is a vastly greater number of poor people who had identifiable concrete political power within local communities. And, you know, whereas in England, the number of landless persons who would likely become great political leaders in a local community was likely close to zero. In China, this happened with quite a bit of frequency.
Now, as you said, things have changed, though.
Yeah.
Society's changed. So is there anything we can still take from this? Is there anything we could try and change about the way society is now, which can build on this?
So you could say things have changed, but perhaps they haven't changed so much that this is completely irrelevant. So for example, you know, South Korea and Japan are still fairly democratic societies. It's actually a matter of contention in those democracies that, you know, having the old people rule society, is that good or bad? Is that damaging to our innovation? Is that damaging to our kind of long-term viability? China, of course, has adopted kind of a much more antagonistic approach towards its traditional culture than either South Korea or Japan has. That said, you know, have they succeeded in burning out the gerontocratic roots of Chinese social culture? My proposal would likely be no. You know, there is quite a bit of evidence that ever since 1978, there has been kind of a revival of traditional extended family-based forms of organization in Chinese society, and much of that actually is gerontocratic. Mm. So in some ways, I could see, as long as the party doesn't go on kind of like another cultural revolution and tries to burn more things down, that you might see a slow revival of gerontocracy. Now, of course, the problem is gerontocracy is good for a narrow set of things. It's good for promoting certain kinds of social equality within certain conditions. But of course, you know, as a general social principle, it has all kinds of problems. And so the challenge in traditional society was how to temper the gerontocracy with more meritocratic forms of higher governance that actually gave society the room to innovate and grow. And of course, the question basically is, you know, can we redesign those kind of higher forms of morality and kind of attach it to this perhaps slowly rewarming gerontocratic base in modern China?
I like to add on a humanistic view to think about this issue, the age-based hierarchy. So in our contemporary time, everything becomes disposable, including human beings, right? You're old, you're out, so you're being disposable. So I think we want to see some old people, not just they are growing old gracefully, but also they are source of wisdom. They experience a lot, they are can give a good advice to a family. For example, grandma seems to have lots of wise things to say, and also provide these moral examples. Mm-hmm. So they are actually good. We should respect elders and also pay attention to them, and also listen to their wisdom can offer to help us to live a better life.
Well, look, thanks so much. It's been very interesting. I think we've, in terms of sort of rethinking our hierarchies, we've perhaps helped the women and older people to sort of get higher than they are at the moment. And we've perhaps taken experts down a peg, maybe, or
and
two.
And taking human down a peg.
Human,
now
yeah.
we have AI on top of this as God, right?
Exactly, exactly. And I'm sure that these hierarchies will remain fluid into the future. Thank you very much.
Okay,
wow, thank you.
Good to be here.
There will be more global perspectives on hierarchy and equality and freedom and harmony in upcoming podcasts. To keep up to date, subscribe to the Microphilosophy iTunes feed or follow me on Twitter at Microphilosophy. And do check out the work of the Berggruen Institute's Philosophy and Culture Centre at philosophyandculture.berggruen.org. So until next time, if nothing prevents, goodbye.